Broadcasting live from the Pro Business Channel studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Capital Club Radio, brought to you by Flock Specialty Finance. Please welcome your host, Chairman and CEO, Michael Flock.
Good morning, and welcome to this edition of Capital Club Radio. We are absolutely excited, delighted today to have Tim Bauer with us. Tim is the current president of Inside ARM and the IA Institute. Inside ARM, of course, as many of you know, is like the leading website information provider for the accounts receivable management industry. Tim is an industry veteran with an incredible resume. He could write the encyclopedia on the debt collection ARM industry over the last 30 years. Tim got into the industry right after law school with the law firm in Minneapolis, Messerly & Cramer, where he was head of that credit and collection department. He then joined Nationwide Credit, running the legal products group. Following that, he was executive vice president for business development at RMA, a major collection agency years ago. Following that, in 2004 to 2006, he was with Outsourcing Solution, Inc., OSI, took it out of bankruptcy, then became was one of the leaders at Academy Collection Service, Inc., ACS, from September 2007 to February 2009. And then he headed up a CEO of Integrity Solution Services, ISS. Tim has many, many stories for us this morning, lessons learned, ups and downs of how to build businesses. Tim, tell us a little bit about your thought process, how you got into this space.
Well, first of all, nobody goes to law school and says, you know, I can't wait to get out and be a collection lawyer. And when I got out, I got the job offer from this firm, Messerly, Rowe, Bailo, and Cramer back then. And they took me in and they said, listen, we don't know which department we want to put you in. And this firm was very interesting. They had a small collection department. They had a lobbying practice in the state of Minnesota. And they had another part of the firm that did aviation crash cases, plaintiff's cases. So I came in and they said, well, you know, we're hiring you and this other guy at the same time. He can't start right away. We need you right now in this credit department. And the guy who started 2 weeks after me went into the aviation crash business and is still doing it today.
Aviation, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, well, not only that, it was very, very specialized. For the longest while, all they did was crash cases involving C-130s.
Okay.
Back in the mid-80s, apparently, they were going down with alarming regularity.
Uh-huh.
But so I got into this firm. We had this collection practice. The guy who hired me left the firm and told everybody, well, I'm taking Tim with me. And I said, well, wait a minute. We never talked about that. I'm staying. And by the way, I'm keeping these clients, and we're going to continue to grow this. So that's how I got into that business.
Right. And you were there, I think you said 15 years?
15 years.
And you were running all the credit and collection operations?
Yeah, we were at the time the largest law firm collection practice in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And we grew it quite rapidly,
mm-hmm.
and it was a very large part of that firm's practices.
Mm-hmm. So why would you want to leave?
Well,
for Nationwide Credit?
I'll tell you two things. I ran what I tell everybody was the squeakiest, cleanest law firm collection practice in the United States, and we did this work for 15 years. And in that 15 years, I had never gotten two things, which were very common in that arena. One, I'd never got an ethics complaint. And ethics complaints against collection lawyers are very, very common. That's right after divorce lawyers, because mm-hmm. everybody goes through a divorce, one party or the other, and in most cases, both think their lawyer did a rotten job, so they turn them into the ethics board.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd never gotten one of them, and I'd never had a fair debt case against us.
Mm-hmm.
And back to back, about 2 weeks apart, I got both.
Mm-hmm.
And the ethics complaint was a letter on a federal student loan that was forwarded to an individual that was in a shelter for battered women. Mm-hmm. Very tragic story. Mm-hmm. But the director of the shelter thought that they should turn me into the ethics board for having this letter forwarded to there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was dismissed in about 2 weeks. But it was still,
right.
You know, having never gotten one of these things, and you get it and you see the Office of Professional Responsibility and the sweat starts pouring down your forehead.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got our first fair debt case against us. A lawyer up there, who I knew very well, thought it was a great idea to sue the law firm, and he named my partner in the lawsuit. And mm-hmm. I just said, "This is nuts." And and at the same time, I was approached by the leadership at it was actually back then it was the company called ACB.
Mm-hmm.
In Phoenix, and, you know, I was living in Minneapolis. Minneapolis, Phoenix, weather-wise, not a tough call.
Right.
And moved out there to – this firm was actually – the leadership was really way ahead of the game. They wanted to start up a legal forwarding department and brought me in to do that.
Okay. Head of the game, meaning that was a new collection process that could make a difference in results? Or?
Well, a lot of the old-time collection agencies had lawyers on retainer where they – to me, it was disgusting. They basically rented their lawyer's letterhead and sent out a bunch of letters under lawyer's
right.
letterhead. I wouldn't have anything to do with that. And so we decided we were going to put more accounts into the litigation process
mm-hmm.
earlier –
mm-hmm.
And engage the top lawyers throughout the country mm-hmm. To do that.
Mm-hmm. So it was a re-engineering opportunity?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And you brought your expertise in legal collections to the game? And,
yeah.
Okay.
I had actually, in my law firm, we started what was then the first legal network out there.
Okay.
It was a group called AACA. Okay. We all have either three or four stupid initials, but... this was American Association of Creditors Attorneys.
Okay. It still exists.
Yeah, it still exists. And we started that, and I went out and recruited the clients to put the
yep.
first volume of accounts through that network.
Okay. And how much difference did it make for the results of ACB, which I guess later became Nationwide?
What
was the impact?
First of all, I was there for about 2 months, and ACB and Nationwide merged.
Okay.
And
that was the Frank Hanna company?
That was the
Nationwide acquired ACB?
It was owned by First Financial here in Atlanta.
Okay.
And
that was Pat, who was the owner of ACB? His name was...
By that time, it was owned by First Data
okay.
when I got there. So First
okay.
Data owned
okay.
ACB, and First Financial owned Nationwide, and First Financial and First Data merged.
Put them together. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And... the ACB management team was convinced they were going to run the whole show.
Yep, yep.
A month later, I was the only member of the senior management team at ACB left standing. Everybody else was gone.
So it was a clash of cultures or organizations?
Yeah, well, it was, yeah. You know, any time you do any mergers, and we can talk about this later, but you don't need three shortstops. You
right.
know, you just you have to make some hard decisions.
Yep.
So, and then... the management team here in Atlanta that ran Nationwide asked me to come out and move out here, and I did.
And you ran the legal collection network for Nationwide then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
And then I got recruited away to join RMA.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. What were some of the lessons learned then throughout that transition from, you know, ACB, Nationwide, and then to RMA? What?
Well, I will tell you what I did learn very quickly, having never been involved in any law firm mergers, you have to make decisions quickly, and you can't do anything other than decide best of the best.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you don't need two shortstops. You don't need three shortstops.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need two chief operating officers.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need two head of ITs. You've got to make the decision, but what you've got to do is take a look at strengths of both
mm-hmm.
and make the decision and live with it.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get through some of those days where the management teams were clashing? Were you like an arbitrator? Did you try to pull the teams together? What?
Well, on the first one with the ACB and Nationwide, I was more of an observer.
Mm-hmm.
As I moved throughout in my career, when I went to RMA, we began
mm-hmm.
acquiring companies.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were involved in the decision-making process as we made the acquisitions. And some decisions are so obvious that it doesn't take a ton of skill to make. We bought a company from Equifax back in the day. They had bought a company called CSC, Credit Services. They were an agency. They had, I want to say something like 14 offices, all small,
right?
Couple fairly large,
right?
But we during our due diligence process, we began to look and said, well, it doesn't make any sense to have all of these offices. We had a small office in Lafayette, Indiana, another office in Indianapolis, and even our financial analysts could come in and say, you know what, at the end of the day, we need these three offices or these four offices, whatever it was, and we're going to merge the other ones into them.
Right.
So
so it's merging real estate, merging infrastructure, organizations.
Yep. You got to take a look at all of it. You know, you have to take a look at leases. You know, you may have an office that you would otherwise say it's too small to keep, but you've got a seven-year lease that you've got to deal with, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And inevitably, I think a lot of these consolidation plays, though, affect people, and people have relationships with customers. How did you navigate through that?
You know, the one thing I learned in doing all these acquisitions is, first of all, confidentiality about the deal is of the utmost importance. The minute word gets out that the company that you're looking at is for sale, people get nervous. Mm-hmm. And it's human nature. If I'm at a company that I hear through the grapevine or the coffee clatch conversation, oh, did you hear we're getting sold?
Mm-hmm.
People get nervous, and people that you don't want to leave, leave.
Mm-hmm.
So the one thing I learned is confidentiality is everything. And so later in my life, when I was at Integrity and we made, I think, five different acquisitions, I was most proud of the fact that on every one of them, I had people call me up and said, you know what, we didn't hear a word about this until the day.
That's the number one lesson learned, confidentiality.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. There is, you know, certainly challenges that way, because you need to, if you're selling, you need to bring in certain portions of your team into the loop.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you've got to impress upon those people the need to, this is need to know only.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And did you have to make an assessments on, I mean, the people, their personalities, their skill sets, their history, their customer relationships? And
there's tons of ways to look at it. You start, you know, for instance, IT is of utmost importance.
Right.
And so you begin to look at systems. In a perfect world, the acquisition you would make is a company that's on the exact same platform that you're on, and so that you can make that transfer very easily.
Mm-hmm.
If not, you've got multiple platforms
right.
that you're going to have to deal with. You've got increased expense to maintain multiple platforms. You've got data in different formats in different locations. It's hard to combine the data. You end up having to create a data warehouse and funnel information up to the data warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
So IT is one of the first times you look at. We talked about real estate, big item.
Mm-hmm.
The other, to me, and this was an area where I always focused in our team, was the clients. Okay, it didn't make sense if I were a buyer, for instance, and my largest client was ABC Bank, it didn't make sense for me to buy a company that whose largest client was ABC Bank, because in our industry, most clients get nervous to concentrate that much work in one company. So, you know, if you make that deal, you're immediately devaluing the company you just bought, because you're not going to be able to maintain both market shares. And the other thing is this whole discussion about confidentiality, it also comes into play with clients. As a seller, you want to control when you're going to tell the clients.
Right.
As a buyer, I'm not going to do the deal. I'm not going to close
until
I talk to these clients.
Right.
So that's friction right from the start as to when that happens.
Right.
And you have to come up with a point in time where both parties agree, okay, now we can go talk.
Mm-hmm. So you really developed lots of M&A experience and expertise along the way. I mean, you started in legal collections, but it sounds like your job, you know, also at RMA, you were in business development, but you were also involved in acquiring businesses.
Yep.
So you really built, you know, your personal kind of skill portfolio along the way as well.
Yeah,
because you were never an M&A guy.
No,
initially.
not at all. And so you learned on the fly on what was important. But at RMA, we had a team of senior execs that were involved in every transaction,
mm-hmm.
and we all took our little section of this. But mm-hmm. as you get into meetings every day, you learn,
right.
you know, from the IT guys what's important,
right.
and I learned from the HR people what's important, you
uh-huh.
know,
uh-huh.
Who's got employment contracts, who does not, who do we need to give an employment contract to that,
right.
To maintain the value of an acquisition,
right.
things like that.
Because RMA, you were head of business development, right?
And then I was chief operating officer for
okay.
3-4 years as well.
Okay. And that's when you got involved in all the M&A work?
Well, and
RMA
actually,
did?
You know, when I went to RMA, I think I was employee number 4.
Okay.
So we did everything.
Right.
And You got a little flavor of everything. But after the first acquisition, then we oddly enough,
mm-hmm.
The first acquisition was a company up in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
which one was that?
It was a company that was called Credit Converters.
Okay.
And the guy that owned it was a legend in the industry, a guy by the name of Jack Hurley.
Okay. Okay.
And Jack was, just a quick side story, Jack was a legendary big game hunter,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, internationally known. Well, our big mm-hmm. game hunter, and mm-hmm. if you went up to the office there, they had all of these animals on the walls everywhere, and you know, it's not me. I mean, I'm not a hunter, and I don't really get it, but I thought, you know, this is what this guy likes. The one I never really understood was the zebra. I didn't understand why anybody would want to go shoot a zebra, but and it was an interesting deal. Right before we closed on that, they were telling us they had a hot prospect lined up, and I won't say who it is, but it was one of the major credit card providers out there.
Yeah.
And they were down to the uh-huh. client was just going to do the last site visit before
right.
placement started, and the lady showed up, walked into the office, saw all of the stuffed animals,
yeah.
walked out, said, I'm
really?
Not doing business with these guys.
Wow, because they're hunters?
Yeah. Because, yeah, it yeah. just it was,
yeah.
she found it offensive.
Offensive.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
So
you weren't politically or culturally correct, I guess.
I was. But,
yeah.
but
right.
The
speaking of culture, by the way, you haven't touched on that, and I know just from my own experience that cultural values can clash sometimes in mergers and acquisitions. And I never really thought it was important until later when I was running companies for Dun & Bradstreet, and I saw, wow, you know, shared values are critical. What stories do you have where that was something you learned?
Well, you know, it is interesting.
Learn, yeah.
When I went to and started Integrity. I went in and was working with a private equity group out of Miami called HIG Capital.
Mm-hmm.
They've also got
an
office here in the Atlanta area.
Right.
And
they still on track?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking to them about what the ideal transaction would be.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, listen, to me, the ideal transaction is we find the company that we like.
Mm-hmm.
We negotiate the right price.
Mm-hmm.
And you give the former owner a bushel basket full of money and say, please go away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because particularly if you're putting companies together, you're often going to make changes to one or two companies. And
mm-hmm.
it's like telling the former owner their baby was ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Any change you make, it's just human nature.
Right.
However, back when we did RMA, and this is, again, things you learn over a period of time, because of the financial markets were such that doing those kind of deals of here, take your money, go, and
mm-hmm.
You just couldn't do that deal.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to do deals where former owners stayed,
right.
had earnouts,
right.
and that is where culture was really a challenge because you've got a former owner who's got a chunk of money now,
right.
more than likely not the same incentive to work as hard as they did before.
Right.
And you are inevitably going to make some changes. And you also get saddled with some of the management team that perhaps you wouldn't – you in perfect world you wouldn't want. But that's because the deal had to be done in that fashion.
And because there's an earnout, you couldn't make those management changes.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
So you were sort of frozen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Real challenge.
Now, at OSI, you said you took that out of bankruptcy.
Well, I don't. I can't take credit for that. I was one of the, part of the management team. I came on just as they were exiting. And what they asked me to do there was relaunch their portfolio purchasing arm, which they had shut down.
Right.
And
how did you do that? How did you relaunch it?
Well, I'll come back to that. But my other piece of that was running the sales team.
Okay.
So we got into the debt buying world at OSI, and we had some deals that we had done in the bag that were in the bag before I got there. And so we had some ongoing transactions, and we did one very large deal that was the largest transaction they had ever done at the time. But what we found out was debt buying at that period of time was absolutely crazy. Prices were stupid.
Stupid high.
Stupid high.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we were bidding on portfolios, and I used to say we're not even in the
this is 06, 07.
Yeah, yeah. We're not even in the wedding party. We're so far removed from the price needed to get that deal done. And so I was there about a year and a half, and was talking to the management team. I said, we can't get a deal because we our model, and they had terrific modeling, but their modeling was based on their historical results on earlier paper.
Right.
And our model would say 8 cents, and, and that paper was selling for 12 cents. So it was a real challenging time.
Now, in OSI and RMA and Nationwide, these were other businesses that someone else had started. You helped take them to the next step. As CEO of Integrity Solution Services, however, that was your baby, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was what you personally initiated.
Yep.
Share with our listeners what really inspired you, what motivated you to personally start that at a time when a lot of other deals like that weren't working out.
Well, and I'll back up. Just before that, I did what I tell everybody was the most professionally rewarding deal of my life. I got a call to talk to the owner of Academy Collection Services up out of Philadelphia. And they were going through an FTC investigation at the time. And it did not look good for them. And so they asked me if I would come up as president of the company and get them through the FTC investigation, get the case settled, and move on. And I remember I get up there and we finally got a meeting with the FTC, and they were going to present to us what the findings they had.
Right.
And we were in their offices in New York, and the chief person there said, "Okay, Mr. Bauer, we know you've got a lot of questions, but we just have one of you first." And I said, "Well, what's that?" And they go, "What are you doing with these guys?" You know,
they had quite a history.
They had a lot of very bad data. They had a site in Las Vegas that really had some challenges, and so, and I remember when I
operational challenges, or legal
compliance challenges. Okay. I remember when I got done with that meeting. It was a Friday afternoon, and I came home that afternoon. Thought about it all weekend, and I got on a flight to Las Vegas on Monday morning, and I went out and fired the top three guys on the branch. And, you know, just, you're gone, you're gone, you're gone.
Because of compliance.
Because of compliance. And
flagrant violations?
It was, over the top.
Okay.
And I brought in a friend of mine who, you can't make this up, but this guy had been in the hospital in a medically induced coma and had been out a couple of weeks, 3 weeks. And I called him up and I said, "Rich, how you feeling?" And he goes, "Oh, I'm getting better." And I said, "Well, what do you think about going out to Las Vegas for me?" And it's a true story. And he went out there And he ended up firing three or four more people down the line.
After he came out of this medically induced coma?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Again, you can't make it up.
Uh-huh.
But we did that. We got the FCC.
He must have liked turnarounds, I guess, and he liked to follow your lead.
Rich was just one of the all-time great guys. What's
his last name?
Plotka.
Plotka, okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, and he did a terrific job for me.
So you turned around Academy.
Well, collection. I don't want to say we turned it around. We got the case settled, and the company got sold.
You fixed the compliance problems.
We had to do a lot of cleanup. And to their credit, they had started a lot of it before I got there, but the people that the FTC had identified, they had actually named them in the complaint, were still working there.
Right.
And I said, this is crazy.
Right.
And so
what was your vision, though, now to Integrity Solutions Service? That was the last deal you did, and that was your baby. You were the founder of it.
Yeah.
Share with our listeners a little bit about your dreams and how you got started. And
well, again, I had been, you know, involved in RMA, where we did a bunch of roll-ups, Nationwide, which had been a bunch of roll-ups, and OSI had been a bunch of roll-ups by the time I'd gotten there. And I thought, geez, I've seen the good, the bad. I've seen things that we would do differently in hindsight, and convinced the people at HIG that this was a good idea to get into this.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my pitch was, the industry is at its all-time low, mm-hmm. and we'll be able to make decent buys because the profits were down. All the things. Price of deals were low.
Right, because of the
market. And so what my pitch was to do the acquisitions exactly as I mentioned before, is give the former owners a bushel basket full of money, have them go away.
Right.
We couldn't do that because to get deals funded.
So you had earnouts then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Earnouts on every deal we did.
Right.
And so
that created a complication, I guess, for the management integration?
Yes, incredibly so.
Yeah.
In a perfect world, if I could do it differently,
right.
I would.
Uh-huh.
But we did deals to get them done. So Integrity made three acquisitions.
And they were
NARS.
NARS.
Pinnacle.
Pinnacle.
Out of Minneapolis. And Integrity.
Okay.
Which then we used that name out of Kansas City.
Kansas City.
A.L. Summerlin's company.
That's right.
And again, we ended up with three systems.
Mm-hmm.
We were on three different platforms, had to make decisions to get to that. And again, you can easily say this,
mm-hmm.
okay, we're going to go to this platform, but harder to do.
Oh, conversions can be nightmares.
Conversions are.
Did it keep you up at night?
It kept the IT people up at night.
Okay.
And the old line, I slept like a baby. I just got up every hour and cried.
Okay.
Integrity was an interesting deal. We had a lot of first party outsourcing work.
Mm hmm.
And we had facilities in Jamaica,
mm-hmm.
and in Panama City, Panama. And what was interesting about that is the facility in Panama City, when I was at RMA,
right.
we had looked at this facility to acquire it.
You walked away from it then?
Well, it wasn't the company. It was an empty Sears store.
Okay.
And I couldn't convince my boss at the time that this was the way we should go.
Right.
And the people who owned NARS.
Right.
It's very funny. We talked to each other afterwards. They were in either a week before or a week after me.
Okay.
Got the same tour that I did.
Right.
Same meeting with the government officials,
yep.
et cetera. They did the deal. We didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a terrific facility for a long time until just before we sold Integrity,
mm-hmm.
the outgoing president
mm-hmm.
unilaterally raised minimum wage down there that
right.
just took the price structure out of control.
Mm-hmm. And when did you sell Integrity?
2 years ago in July.
And the buyer was?
It was initially a lady out of India. And she owned it for about 30 days and in turn sold it to Radius.
Okay. Gotcha.
Michael Barrist again.
Right. And Radius just acquired Northlands.
Yes.
Came out. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They've been very active. It's Michael and Stephen were, you know, the key guys at NCO.
Right.
And they were out of the business for a couple of years and have come back in quite nicely.
So fast forward now to Inside ARM. You went from being a founder, CEO of a large ARM services company. Now you're with the leading website information services provider in our industry. Tell us a little bit about your plan for that, and how did you make the leap, and how's it going?
Well, I jokingly tell people that I got out of this lousy industry and stayed in this lousy industry all at the same time. In that, I got tired of the litigious environment, the TCPA cases, the fair debt cases, and the challenges of day-to-day business. Mm-hmm. Now I get to cover the industry, and I get to write about it, and I didn't throw away any of my contacts.
Mm-hmm.
So I get to, you know, talk to clients that I've had for done work with forever, and other agency people.
Okay, and our listeners, you know, are I'm sure dying to know what your thoughts are on the implications of the Trump presidency for, you know, our industry and the highly regulated, you know, nature of it, the CFPB, the TCPA. What are your thoughts on that, and what words of wisdom can you share with everyone?
First of all, I don't know that anybody knows for sure, but, you know, things seem to be changing on a daily basis. But I think if you look at the two entities that have the biggest impact in our space, mm-hmm. I'll start with the FCC mm-hmm. because of the TCPA. The President-elect Trump will have two commissioners that he will appoint mm-hmm. After he is in office, mm-hmm. Which will flip that commission from a Democratic-controlled commission to a Republican-controlled commission. Current Chairman Wheeler is Democrat. His term does not expire until 2018.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, so that could change things.
Right.
You know, we've gotten their rule that they proposed, their rulemaking back in July of 2015.
Mm-hmm.
was very anti-business,
mm-hmm.
And particularly anti-businesses that had relationships with consumers.
Right.
You know, the ARM industry has been killed by this term robocall.
Right.
Okay, and robocall, and that statute was designed uh-huh. to limit telemarketers who had no prior relationship with an individual mm-hmm. who were just randomly calling phone numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it has been twisted mm-hmm. to involve companies that have relationships with the mm-hmm. the consumer,
mm-hmm.
and any call made using an auto dialer, automated telephone dialing system,
mm-hmm.
and what it's done, it's turned the industry back 20 years to mm-hmm. making manual calls, which put compliance risk out there because many people use the equipment.
Mm-hmm.
to cover all the time zone restrictions and make sure they're you're calling the West Coast only at times you can call the West Coast, et cetera. And now you've said, no, we don't want you to use any of that technology that was good.
Right. So standardization becomes very difficult.
Yeah. Because that's a robo-dialer,
right.
a robo-call.
Right.
So that's hurt. The bigger one, the bigger issue everybody's looking at is what will become of the CFPB.
CFPB. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Director Cordray's term expires in 2018 as well. There was a very recent case decided in October called PHH versus the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the result of that case was a decision out of the Court of Appeals that said the structure of the CFPB as it stands mm-hmm. was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. They have a single director that the president could only fire for cause.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just last Friday, late Friday afternoon, the CFPB filed an appeal. But it's not truly an appeal. They've asked the Court of Appeals to hear the case again in bank, which means all members of the Court of Appeals rather than the initial three-person panel that heard the case. But highly unlikely that that will get heard mm-hmm. or in a decision out of that before the inauguration.
Mm-hmm.
So in theory, there are lots of speculation will – President-elect Trump terminate Director Cordray.
Mm-hmm.
Will Director Cordray resign?
Yep.
Then there's the issue of rulemaking that's gone on. There are two rules that are
rulemaking in CFPB or
rulemaking
with the
in the
FCC?
CFPB. Okay. CFPB. They've okay. got three areas of rulemaking that really are very critical right now. One is in the arbitration rule. Mm-hmm. The CFPB would like to eliminate all mandatory arbitration clauses mm-hmm. so mm-hmm. that we can create more class action litigation right. for class action lawyers. I may be the only lawyer in the world who hates class action litigation.
I think so.
That was fairly far along, and the question is, will the CFPB try to get that through before the inauguration? I doubt it. Mm-hmm. Payday lending rules, another hot topic, and then the one that we're all interested in the arm industry are the debt collection rules.
Right.
And, you know, the issue there is they have gone so far as to issue an outline of proposed rules.
Right.
And they had what they call a SBRIFA hearing, which is meeting with small businesses to talk about the financial impact of their proposed rules. So everything's up in the air. Will the rulemaking go forward under a new regime? Will they stall somehow? Will it go forward faster? And will priorities change? And I personally think, here my thought is, I think it's potentially likely that the CFPB will be restructured as a commission like the
So it won't be eliminated completely.
No, I it's hard to argue right. against consumer protection. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, those of us in the arm industry, we would love to see some more regulation on the FDCPA. It's a statute from 1977, completely right. outdated, doesn't address issues of how consumers want to be contacted today. They want to be contacted on their cell phone, text, emails. They don't want to be called on the phone. Mm-hmm. But you've got a statute that doesn't address that at all.
Right.
So, but I if I would bet, and I don't gamble, because but if I would, I would say it gets reconstituted as a commission, five-person commission, and rulemaking continues, but perhaps with more pro-business leaning on a couple critical issues. And the one most critical is the number of call attempts. Mm-hmm. The outline of proposals that is out there right now has got fairly stringent restrictions on number of attempts to call a person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Tim, it seems like your career has come full circle here in the last 30 years. You started in legal collections. You got into operations. You got into business development, doing M&A work, became a founder of a major collection agency, and now, you know, president of Inside ARM, and you're back into the focus on legal again because of the compliance issues which dominate the industry. We're going to wrap it up. What parting kind of words of wisdom do you have for other younger Tim Bowers that are coming up in the industry today? What would you like to share with them in closing?
Well, you know, that's a good question, this just came up. I had breakfast the other day with an individual that's a chief compliance officer at a company here in Atlanta, and I was asked this very same question, and I said, you know what, get diverse, spread out, get wide and deep. You know, you've got your legal background that'll never leave you. And if you want to practice law again, you can practice law again. I have no desire to do that.
Right.
But if asked to get involved in operations or asked to get involved in HR, do it, because I think the legal background is something that everybody always will see and say, well, okay, that's a skill set, a way of thinking that we can use. But if you've got exposure to these other areas, you can do a lot more.
Go wide and deep.
Yep.
That's your advice for young people coming up in this space.
That's what we used to tell our sales team about clients.
Yeah.
Go wide, go deep.
Well, that's exactly what you did in your 30 years in this industry. And Tim, again, many, many thanks for taking our listeners through your history in the ARM industry and implications for the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you for joining Michael Flock and his guests on the Capital Club Radio Show. For more information on future interviews, please visit us at flockfinance.com. This program is brought to you by Flock Specialty Finance, where clients are provided knowledge and insights to help them grow their business in complex and risky markets. Flock is more than a transaction.